Good morning, everyone. If I could have your attention. Well, I'm Kirsten Moy, and I'm the director of the Economic Opportunities Program, a policy program, the Aspen Institute. I'd like to welcome all of you this morning to the special breakfast session of the Family Economics, Work and Wealth in the New Economy track. It's a special track sponsored by the Casey Family Programs and the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and focuses on the special challenges that working families, low-income families, and families of color experience trying to make it in our society today. I would like to introduce Eric Cooper, the president of the National Urban Alliance for Effective Education. And I think you're in for a treat this morning. Eric's going to tell us about some special work he's doing with urban public school districts. And you're going to get to see a preview of a segment of a film, In a Perfect World, which will be coming out?
Shortly.
Okay.
Do I need it? Oh, no, I don't need this. You can take that. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Bless you all. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, as I look over the audience, I say to myself, we have to honor some of the leaders who are in this room. For instance, over here is Kate Roberts, and the work that you're doing with Youth AIDS is very, very important. Thank you very much for your work. Back there is Bishop T.D. Jakes from Seattle, who hopefully many of you have seen the article about him in the New York Times. I just loved it. Bishop, we're also working in Seattle, so we have some things in common. I also want to acknowledge the president of Gamilla, Manuela Nelson, and the president of the In a Perfect World Foundation, Linda. My colleagues, Dr. Yvette Jackson, who you'll hear from briefly after the film. She's the chief executive officer of the NUA, our organization. Jerry Lauber, he's also the chief operating officer of the NUA. And we wanted this to be a very small opportunity to introduce what we feel is a very important program that emerges out of the voices of the children and youth who we feel are being underserved, who we feel are being tracked into positions that disempower rather than empower. What you will see in a few moments are issues from the voices of the students, of the children, and of the youth, crying out to us to reach out and provide support for them. In a way, the title, A New Way Forward for American Schools, really is consistent around framing a new future for the emerging new majority. And that's reality that you know we all face. And that's reality for us in this country to celebrate. And yet, we know whenever you have a discussion about schooling in America, you have to talk about the interplay of race and poverty and how it interacts on the achievement of the students who are most in need. We do not call in our organization, the National Urban Alliance, we do not call these students at risk. We do not call these students emotionally disturbed. We call these students who often are struggling in families where the mother holds two or three jobs. We call them school-dependent children. Malcolm Gladwell, in his wonderful book, The Tipping Point, talks about the importance of good neighborhoods and how it impacts on a child. In fact, good neighborhoods trump good families. A child from a good family who is existing in a neighborhood that is challenged will not do as well as a child who is in a good neighborhood and has a bad family. The research, or a challenged family, the research is quite clear that the impact that poverty and race has on achievement needs to address. So, very briefly, I want to frame a new future for our new majority. And some of the framing involves that poverty is a circumstance and not an identity, number one. Number two, poverty is not destiny. I do not believe that social demography needs to be destiny. The reason why many students fail is because we maintain low expectations or lack of belief in the capacity of all children to succeed. We define intelligence by how well we perform on standardized measure. And yet we know, based upon Jerome Bruner's definition of intelligence, intelligence is not what you know, but what you do when you don't know what to do. Now, taking that definition to a new application, it basically means that those children who are forced to survive in challenged family circumstances basically are all gifted children. I would ask many of you, to see how well you would do in challenged circumstances in Philadelphia, in Seattle. But many of these children survive through perseverance, and that's what you're going to be seeing here. So poverty is a circumstance, not an identity. Poverty is not destiny. And poverty, race, and social class must be recognized as primary reasons why we have disparities. And the point that you're going to hear framed by us and framed by the students is that we cannot rely on heroic educators or charter schools to solve the problem of schooling in America. We have got to recognize that public schools are the foundation for our society, for our American society. And most importantly, and not recognized clearly, the single most important movement that has ever happened in the world, was the American Civil Rights Movement. And it was led primarily by black faith-based leaders who believed in what Martin Luther King said, that you have to have one foot in the scripture and one foot in the Constitution, that you have to find ways of building on the capacity that exists in our churches, in our communities, in combinations with schools that know how to reach out to the churches, reach out to the community leaders, reach out to the leaders who exist, the stakeholders in the community. I'm getting riled up real fast. Early for that, but I'm getting riled up. Primarily because when you hear the voices of the students, when you hear them crying out, as we have heard them, in tears to us, believe in me, as an individual who has been placed on here by the Lord, or whatever has brought him, her, to our environment. Believe in me. Don't deny me equal opportunity and equitable circumstances for my life. Believe in me. Just because my skin color might be different than yours, believe in me. Just because I might be living in poverty, struggling with a family, seeing my mother shot in front of me, as we have seen in students across America that we work. Recognize that the power for change, the power for intelligence exists within all of us. And if you hear a hopeful message coming from me in my brief marks, it's borrowing on Barack Obama's phrase that he used at the Democratic Convention. Remember, he talked about the audacity of hope, the boldness of hope that leads us to that new future. It is that hopefulness rather than hopelessness that we are trying to show and depict in the work. In a presentation yesterday, the head of the NEA provided a blueprint for us to follow. And I thought it was rather important to restate what she indicated. Number one, decentralized activity in communities so that we in communities think globally and act locally. The second point that the director of the NEA mentioned, localized support of leadership and community interventions where the community leaders are empowered to change. And number three, personalized intervention that enables the individual to gain the level of empowerment that enables him or her to lead in the community. We would add a fourth. And the fourth one is a universalized application of what we know are universal themes that are critical for change. And they are, from our standpoint, number one, strong belief in the capacity, the irrefutable belief that every single child in America is capable of graduating from high school and capable of doing well in college. Hope that helps to move forward that belief and application. Determination, determined with confidence to begin to move forward. And the final one is confidence. And what you're going to see right now are confident children who speak for all of us from their heart, from their mind. And what they are looking for us to do is to reach out our hand to help guide them. Because if we don't, they will reach out to a gang for that sense of security. They will reach out. They will become nihilistic, primarily because they do not feel like they belong in a society that values who they are. Thank you very, very much for coming here, whether you're here by accident or purposeful. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you. I want to acknowledge the producer, Norman A. Klotz.
Norman.
Norman, if you don't get an Academy Award, at least nominated for the targeted release that we hope will happen in the next coming year, I will be very disappointed. I hope you understand the universality of the themes that I talked about earlier, captured by the students. Yes. I think what we're calling for and what we're trying to reinforce is that new social justice movement that I mentioned briefly. And we believe it has to be led by educators. But it means educators need to become empowered and realize that they can get out of the boxes of their classroom. But it means that they also have to reach out to community stakeholders. And that includes the Board of Education, it includes the mayors, it includes governors that we reach out to. Most importantly, it includes the faith-based leaders that exist in the community. So that there is a coalition of people that begin to address the fact that if we are going to get sustained change for those 25% of the population whose needs are not being met, if we are going to, and I'm going to talk about this more extensively with Marion Bolden, the superintendent of Newark, who is here, who will be presenting with us later this afternoon, if we are going to address the herding of children of color into prisons, then we have to begin to understand and reflect on the power of the adult to lead the child. Those children were asking for us to lead. In respect to that, we have found a single most important in-school factor for achievement is teacher effectiveness, teacher quality, who have been there. We recognize and we reinforce those teachers who are doing a great job, but all too many teachers do not maintain high expectations, probably because they've been beaten down over the years by the system, by their experiences and their frustrations. So they basically transfer self-fulfilling prophecy onto the child. Well, it's not my fault that you're not learning. It's your fault. It's the fact that parents are not involved. It's the fact that you are not working hard enough. Charter schools in that context, I support all heroic adults who are doing things to help children. But really understand the fact that charter schools, in my opinion, are a Band-Aid for the deeper problems that exist within this country. And unless we begin to understand the impact of the family and define more broadly by stakeholders in the community, we will continue to fail. And unless we empower the teachers to find their voice, to become part of this new social justice movement, they will fail. So I hope that answers your question. Yes, Seth Green, who heads up a wonderful youth movement. Yes.
And they sense this need that we have all of these issues interwoven in the community, and they feel very overwhelmed. And I think they have this reversal where they believe in the kids, and then by the end, many come out jaded. And that always surprises me because they're such kind of naive but optimistic people when they go in. My question is, are you thinking about how this can be kind of piloted in one or two kind of urban communities? It seems like such an ambitious goal to get all of these different stakeholders together. And it seems like, I know they would love to, when they go to Teach for America, have some type of roadmap for how they could build this type of community coalition. Is that something that's being kind of piloted in a couple cities? And is there like a toolkit being developed for other communities?
Seth is not a plant. Thank you very much for the question. Understand this, that we're not about piloting. There's more of an urgency here. If you go into prisons like we do, and you see those children being lost because of the attitudes, if you see what we see, where the penal system actually decides when, how many prisons they're going to build based upon the scores of a child in a community at the second and third grade, understand the urgency of the issue. Teachers need to be supported and built up. It's through professional development. What we're trying to do with this communications campaign is really create an opportunity to reinforce people in communities. And we're not talking about two or three, Seth. We're talking about 26 schools. We are talking about, from some of the clips that you saw, and we were supposed to have data here, and they lost it somewhere in the maze of the boxes that come into Aspen. In the one community where the girl was dancing, that's Hopkins, that's in a suburb, which is an integration busing initiative with 13 districts out of Minneapolis. The children who were bused, who had support through our work, our supporting of the teachers, tripled the achievement. Tripled. Not one full standard DA. Thanks for, you should definitely applaud. Thank you, Seth. Give me five on that. Tripled the achievement of those children in the Minneapolis magnet schools and the regular schools who did not participate in the kinds of professional development training that those teachers who we were working with, who are working with the students that you saw here, experienced. We have seen full standard deviations. In fact, in a school in Newark, we saw almost two full standard deviations of improvement over a course of 3 years for the 15th Avenue School. So it's not about kids' inability to do it. And yet in our society, there are millions of dollars poured into creating a belief system that certain kids just can't do it. I'll name them. Smith Richardson Foundation, Scaife Foundation, Bradley Foundation. In the Bradley Foundation, the person with the Bradley Fellowship, his name is Charles Murray. He wrote, and again, we'll talk about this more extensively. He was one of the co-writers of the Bell Curve. On page 526 of the Bell Curve, he says that we should give up. We should give up on children of color who are challenged by poverty and create Indian reservation type, quote, for those kids while America goes about its business. And he wrote this again in 2005. In fact, if you read Forbes magazine by Dan Seligman, what does he say? Dan Seligman said, give it up on these kids because they just don't have the intelligence to do it. Now, you're telling me those children don't have the intelligence to do it? It's changing a belief, and it's recognizing that the new civil rights movement has got to begin in the schools, not in the streets, but in the schools. You're next. Thank you.
Most of what I've seen, I think probably most of the people here accept, and that I'd call, is there a will? Yeah. I mean, a lot of what you talk about is developing the will. But what I'd be curious if you can spend 1 minute, say, what is the way? Now, by the way, I mean, assume a perfect agreement on the will. Of course, it seems fairly obvious, you know, a lot of kids are perfectly capable, and you've got to get to them and educate them. And some things work better than others. All right, what works better? What should we, what is it? If somebody comes to you and says, what do I do at this school board? What specifically have you found that you would advocate to do, assuming the money, assuming the will? Now what?
Now, we did not prepare for all these questions. This is this is great, though, because there is that urgency, and I'm glad that people are speaking up. And I'll take one more question. I'm going to respond to that real quickly. Our focus, usually it's outside in. Our focus is in, out. You have to start with the classroom. You have to start with the teachers who do not believe, who become cynical in their belief. And you have to model and demonstrate, as we do, that those kids can learn. From there, you move out to the principal. From there, you move out to the Board of Education. You enlist the support of dynamic leaders such as Marion Bolden to get behind the movement, as she's doing. And she calls for, she's a superintendent of Newark, as she calls for these things. It is her job to bring the boards along. That's her particular position. And so I guess what, in answer, just a quick way of saying this, the process is in the publication. There are many publications. There are.
Tell us for people who are not in education what it is. How do you get there?
I mean, is it better to move the kids,
give us
take the inner city kids out, and move them on?
I'm sorry. We will
come
promise.
And answer the question. I get too riled up too quickly. And then there's one more question
there.
Okay.
Good morning. I want to respond directly to you. First of all, you have to change the focus. Right now, think about this. Your focus is your reality. Because of the policies that are out there in education now, the focus in urban areas is on weakness. The teachers are supposed to go in, look at data, and spend the entire year focusing on weakness. That's number one. Now, think about that. Think about your own growing up. Imagine if your mother or father said to you, all day, every day, all we're going to do is focus on your weakness. You cannot go to the theater. You cannot have art classes. You cannot go on trips. We're only going to focus on your weakness. What would you start believing about yourself? That what you have is what? Weakness. So the first thing you do with the community school board is say, we're not going to focus on remediation. We are going to focus on high intellectual performance. So what do I mean about that? My background is in gifted and talented education, and I went into it because I wanted to see where the policies came from. Who said that 3 to 5% of a population was gifted? Do you know how they came up with that? That was not based on longitudinal research. It was based on money. What the feds did was say that we are going to allocate 3 to 5% of money to programs for gifted. So people started believing that and started allocating that. What I am saying to you is we go into a school district and we say we are going to focus on high intellectual performance. What is it that we have to do that's going to get our students to perform at a very high level? Number one. Number two, the whole first month of school should only be focusing on student strengths. Imagine that. That's the antithesis of what I first said. So we train teachers to elicit from the students, what is it that you're really good at? Why do you think you're good at it? How did you get good at it? And the same for the teachers. This is about empowering the teachers to give to students the power to give their voice. So community school boards, instead of saying, let's look at the data where the students are weak, the community school boards should be saying, let's look at the data that's showing where the students' strengths are, and let's start incorporating the kind of programs that are going to focus on those strengths. So, Bishop, you are from Seattle. So, John Stanford, I'm sorry. I'm still thinking Seattle. But let me tell you about Seattle, okay? There was a superintendent in Seattle. His name was John Stanford. He was general. Some of you probably know. He was very close to Colin Powell. He went into Seattle, and what he said is, we are going to take every Friday to have our teachers, especially in the secondary, to go out and have to work in the area of their discipline. Because what we have found out is that teachers are not sharing with students how you really apply your knowledge in a discipline. The students are saying, show me why this is important for me to learn. You've probably heard that. Are they saying that? Show me why this is really important. The problem in our schools is teachers who teach a particular discipline in secondary level have never gone out and worked in that discipline. They've only taught in that discipline. So when we ask students to come into a discipline to be prepared, the teachers are not prepared to really show that. So a second thing or a third thing that you can actually do for your community is say, what do we set up for teachers to get out and actually learn how to apply knowledge, bring it back to students so they then can be involved and engaged. Fourth, there is a huge digital divide in schools. Our students are very, very well equipped. I'm talking about in urban areas. They can manipulate data. They can use the internet. And yet, when teachers are asked to look at where students are weak, what do they respond with? Books. They're not asked to, the students are not shown how to use digital learning as a way to go out there and connect to the rest of the world, and yet that is the way of the world. So go back to the community school board and say, what are we doing about digital learning for our students? We should, now there are a couple of school systems out there where they have actually gotten rid of most of the books. Not as a way of saying the books are bad, but by saying there's a whole other world of resources out there that we have to get our students engaged in. And I'm going to tell you the fifth thing that's really important, and that is the terminology that is used that is so pervasive that keeps the eye on weakness. So I'll give you an example. Right now, many people still use the term minority, right? And in the urban areas. In the urban areas we work at, where 99% of the students are students of color, how the heck are they minorities? Think about that. What do you mean when you say somebody's a minority also? Think about this in terms of South Africa. When there was apartheid and you had a very small population of people who were Caucasian, were they ever called minorities? Now, why weren't they called minorities? Because as long as you're termed a minority, you are powerless. Think about the House of Representatives and the Senate. When you say a party is the minority party, what does that mean? It means that they don't have the power. So you have to stop, change the terminology. Kyrie, the girl who was the dancer, she kept using the term students of color. Because what she wants to say is, I am not a minority. I may be a student of color. There is language sends a message. The other thing you can do is stop using the term low achievement. It is underachievement. There is a difference, right? What's the difference? When I say the difference, what do you hear? I don't care that if you're not in education. What's the difference when you say somebody's a low achiever as opposed to Seth is an underachiever? What would that imply? Sorry, Seth. No. You're good plants. Go ahead. What would you say? I see. Absolutely. So what am I saying? You're going back to the school boards. You're talking about digital learning. What do we do to get students out there to be part of the real world? How do we change the focus? Focus on high intellectual performance. Look at student strengths. Yes, ma'am.
I know, like, there's a
question for the I know you've been writing a long time, so we're going to...
We actually have another 10 minutes, so we'll take...
Okay.
Eric, you can take
it.
My name is Pat Alper, and I'm very passionate about this subject as well. I'm a donor and a contributor to an organization that is worldwide based out of New York. It's called the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship, and it is a wonderful do. And I love it because it's sort of a merging of business and education, and it centers on urban schools. And the founder of the organization created an easy MBA book, and it has won all kinds of publishing awards in education, and the organization teaches teachers how to teach business, and they go into schools, and they're in 10 hub cities around America, and I have launched a program in the Washington, D.C. area called Adopt a Class, and what I do, and I do this myself, I've been doing it for 5 years, I go myself into school because I come from business. And I actually help the teacher teach, and I mentor the kids. For a student to graduate from the class, they have to write and defend a business plan. The monies that are contributed launch them into little mini
Excellent.
Businesses. So every student learns a new language. They learn the language of strategic analysis and mission statements and marketing. And I can tell you how wonderful it is. I see kids transform from not even being able to look you in the eye, to starting a lawn mowing business and having 8 steady clients and making $250 a day. And they're happy to meet you and shake your hand. I mean, the stories are unbelievable. And I have about 25 CEOs in the Washington area contributing their time and their money. So it's a real action-oriented
That's what it takes. And
plan.
I think what she's also saying, yeah, I agree. I think what she's also saying, which I think is important, is that there's no silver bullet. There's no panacea. It really does take a whole set of activities. And yet, we know, right now, what is the silver bullet for education reform? Charter schools. And that's not... I know, for instance, KIPP, Knowledge is Power programs, which has some very successful schools. But I know several that have gone down in Chicago that are not doing well. The point of the matter is that we have to reach out across to each other so that we can find ways of reinforcing the work that is there. But we need, most importantly, a level of advocacy to begin to emerge in the country that enables more people, if you're going to scale, to hear the message of a change in belief. But also, what are the key interventions that can be used and how do they engage more people in the communities? And that's where we, in targeted areas, have been very successful, not just with one school, but with 20 schools, 25 schools in Indianapolis, with 60 schools in Seattle. The point of the matter is we have got to show that this is not just a school-by-school initiative. Yes?
I would like to just say one really positive thing. I work in the New York City public schools, and I do...
Microphone. New York City.
She has the microchips next.
Giving teachers tools that they can use to help kids. And I would like to say that 85% of the teachers I work with are so passionate about helping their students that I think we have a great resource, and I think a lot of us who aren't in the schools don't realize this because we see all the negative statistics coming out. But when you go into the classroom and you see the teachers hungry for tools, how do I work with these kids who are having trouble paying attention, whose self-esteem is so low for all the reasons you've been talking about? And when I work with them, and then they send me letters afterwards, and they say, this is so wonderful, we feel so good about it. And I realize something that I didn't know 2 years ago before I started doing this, that at least 80% of the teachers in the public schools of New York City, and I imagine in other cities all over the nation, are trying so hard and care so much and don't have prejudices against any of their kids. They work with them because, as the other woman said, I can't remember where she went, they don't look at them as minorities because this is the whole class. Everybody looks the same in these classes because the whites have fled. And it's a beautiful, beautiful atmosphere in so many of these schools. But they don't have gyms, they don't have enough books, they don't have lots of things that they need, and they don't have moral support from society and often from the administration of the schools, because sometimes the principals and the superintendents are so wound up in big problems that they can't even get to the teachers and give them the credit that they need. And there are a lot of wonderful people out there.
Thank you.
I have a question. I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Yvette.
You mentioned focus on high intellectual performance and not remediation. I'm curious, unless you determine who needs remediation, how do you get the high intellectual performance?
Segue. I think the point is that you do have to do, you have to survey what students know and what they don't know. What I'm saying right now is that even though that kind of data is being looked at, the only side that's being looked at are the weaknesses. I'm saying that you have to look at both. So let's talk specifically about how we work in a district, and maybe that will help set the context for where I'm getting to. First of all, districts call us and say, they find us on the internet, and because we are called the National Urban Alliance, they figure that we can do a focus on students who are underachieving. So we go into a district, and the first thing that we say is, we're going to look at what is traditionally considered important in gifted and talented programs. Meaning, in gifted programs, you also take student data. But what you do is say, this is where the students are really strong. So we first are going in and we do something that's called an instructional assessment. An instructional assessment looks at where students and teachers are strong. What are some of the great things that are already going on in the schools? But we also hear student voices. That's why when Manuela decided to actually be the executive producer on this, it was so critical and important to us, because usually students are not asked about what they're good at or what their particular needs are. So we do an instructional assessment and we work with the district to come up with a professional development plan that's going to help students, or I should say the teachers, to focus on strengths. So what we look at is to actually analyze the standards. You know how all these teachers are very afraid of the standards that are at? If you look at the standards right now, the standards focus on high intellectual performance abilities, meaning they say, how do students know how to evaluate? How do they learn how to make decisions? How do they become critical thinkers? And that's not what we're focusing on. So we're trying to say, let's take those key terms and actually come up with the kind of strategies that get teachers geared up to improving and transforming their instructional process. Now, that's the classroom. But the other side, and Eric, maybe you want to talk about Albany, because that gives a good context about getting the stakeholders together.
Well, very often we see initiatives fail, primarily because the community is not engaged. We have to simultaneously, when working with schools, engage the community and change the beliefs that are there, because schools are just a reflection of the community that they exist in. In my town, Stamford, Connecticut, where I live, my 11-year-old and my 10-year-old, I'm always writing op-ed pieces. I'm always taking on people who believe that certain children are incapable. And when I go to the basements of schools and middle schools, I see 100% of the kids in Stanford who have been labeled emotionally disturbed as African-American boys. Now, we have a crisis in America, but it's not all boys. The crisis is with African-American boys, in particular, in terms of how they are dealt with. So I think that our work links the classroom with the boardroom, with the pulpit, with the political leaders that are there, so that change is sustained. Otherwise, New York City is a good example. You have a new superintendent or chancellor comes in, and new policies are created. I agree with many of the things that are going on in New York City and disagree tremendously. Subtly, I hope it wasn't too subtle, you saw our emphasis on the arts and the importance of arts. Now, I know in New York City and many large urban areas, teachers are pulling their hair out because they want to be able to teach. They want the freedom to be able to teach, but they're being forced to teach to these silly tests that are standardized. I want the students to nail those tests right away so we can get to the important goals. And what we've learned from research is that you do not have to start with basic skills to get to high intellectual performance. You can start with teaching kids inferential comprehension to get at literal comprehension. You can begin to uncover for the kids the natural clues that exist in the texts that they are being asked to use, so that we don't become slaves to the material, slaves to the standards. We are individualizing, as the gentleman from NEA said, in a way that transforms those kids. If that child, the last one in the wheelchair, was not allowed to enter education or advanced thinking and academics, was not allowed through the art, which is a strength of his, we would have short-circuited not only the opportunity for him in his life to succeed academically, we would have relegated him to the back of the classroom where many of those kids, or put them in isolated experiences. So I guess when we think about change, we have to be broad-based, and we have to be recognizing that no one can be the one voice for sustained change. It really does take dynamic partnerships that can emerge. Marion.
I just wanted to respond to the question that was asked earlier.
Newark Public Schools.
And the issue that Yvette put on the table about always dealing with the weaknesses. Well, you're aware of what's going on in New Jersey. We just resolved a budget crisis. Well, I got a memo from the Commissioner of Education 2 weeks ago, and she said, shut down your summer program. Only deal with issues of remediation. And that seems to be the only thing that people understand is necessary. Well, we did not let that happen. And we didn't let it happen because there's an advocacy group that we have. I'm the superintendent because a group of ministers came to me and said, we think that you could do this job. And I said, when I need you, will you be there? Well, it was the community that said, that will not happen in Newark. In our city, which is undergoing so many changes and so many crises in terms of just safety, enrichment was very important. Internships was important. I would almost give up the remediation to do the other. So as it turned out, because of the community advocacy, we were able to implement our program the way we know we need to. And we said, we'll give something else up. We're not going to do that. So, you know, the weakness is what, and I said, this is incredible that someone would say to me, this is what you have to do. But we do know how to communicate, and we did it not in an adversarial way. We got people to understand in our community there are certain things we recognize as a need, and we have been able through NUA, we've quadrupled the number of AP courses in our school district, and we struggle. And what people don't recognize is that Newark, the city, and Newark, the school district, they've been separate up until now. Now we got a new mayor. And so now we're going to come together, and our advocacy is going to be even stronger. But there are a lot of things strategically that you can do. But that belief and fighting for what you know is right is also very critical. I just wanted to give you a very practical.
And I might add, and we're going to take one more, Rick.
Certainly not Bill Gates size, but one of the things we've gotten involved in is Team Academy, and I've met with Cory Booker and whatever. How do you view team within the broader context of the Newark educational system?
We have Team Academy, we have KIPP, we have a lot of charters. Charters in our district don't come through the local municipality. They are contracted through the state. So I don't, and we were talking about this, I don't think that the charters are the answer either. But I do think that there are options. For example, in Newark, we've lost most of our Catholic schools. So in place of that, we've got charter schools. We work with the charter schools, but because I have 72 schools that are the most disadvantaged, most of my time, all of my time, is focused on those 42,000 youngsters. But somebody talked about KIPP was created in our district through Teach for America Corps. And I have a strong partnership with Teach for America. In fact, they used to serve five or six districts in the state of New Jersey. They only recruit for Newark at this point because I get teachers from Teach for America that have the high expectations. My problem with that is they only stay in our district 2 or 3 years. So we're trying to create some things so that the incentive or motivation for them staying would be a much longer tenure.
I guess
the reason to me that's important is that most of us who are trying to make a difference here don't have the resources to take on the whole system. And I think we have to figure out ways that we can help further the process and bite off things like your initiative over there that are positive and hope they get to some scale. And so it goes back to the question of how you can really make a difference here.
Change is complex, as Rick and all of us know. It does not take that much money if it's used strategically in support of leadership. We're not talking about more money being poured in. There's sufficient money in public education for those schools to succeed. It has to be used better. And what we're saying is that it's got to begin with the recognition of how important the teacher is. New York Times had an editorial that teachers matters. I went, duh. I mean, when those doors are closed, whether you're in a charter school or in a regular public school, teachers matter. I think what needs to be addressed are the policies that act as predictable obstacles, such as those policies that reinforce the continuance, the sustainability of institutional racism. Let's call it for what it is. When you have all black children in special ed and labeled as emotionally disturbed, it's institutionalized racism, the effects of. When you have 72% of the prison population in my state of Connecticut who are people of color, you have effects of institutionalized racism. To change that, we have to cleanse ourselves of the conditioning that has been pushed on us, the social engineering that has made us believe that certain kids are capable and certain kids are not. I want to thank you for coming to this breakfast this morning, and thank you for being part of the Aspen Institute. How glorious a place and how fortunate we are, which I will repeat again, be part of this Ideas Festival. Thank you very much for all that you do on behalf of kids. Thank you.